well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. All right, so we've had 24 hours, I think now, without any comments by administration officials suggesting that carrying two magazines is a sign of nefarious intent or that you don't have the right to carry at a protest. So we don't need to talk about that today. Instead, I thought what we'd do is actually kind of focus on what's going on around the country now that many states, not all of them, but many states, legislative sessions have begun. Bills are starting to move, both pro and con, when it comes to our right to keep and bear arms. So we're going to do like a state of the state roundup here. I've talked a lot about what's going on in Virginia. Unfortunately, there was another hearing yesterday, and we are going to have to talk about it again because there were some really bad bills that were advancing. But I'd want to start in New Mexico. You know, we talked with the folks from the New Mexico Shooting Sports Association not long ago as Zach Ford joined us on the program. And the last time we spoke, we knew that a gun and magazine ban bill that also impacts FFLs in the state, we knew it had been introduced. It hadn't gotten a bill number yet. And, you know, Zach talked about this is a 30-day budget session in New Mexico this year. So things are going to have to move pretty quickly. And unfortunately, that bill is now on the move. SB 17 is its official title. Well, it's the official bill number anyway. And a hearing held yesterday in the Senate Health and Public Affairs Committee, SB 17 did advance on a party line vote, 6-4. It does not hit the Senate floor yet. Its next stop is the Senate Judiciary Committee. And there were some interesting talking points raised by the anti-gunners in the committee hearing yesterday. As the New Mexico Shooting Sports Association reported, proponents of SB 17 actually argued that the only reason why somebody would want a magazine that holds more than 10 rounds is to commit mass murder. That's it, right? Not because you might want to protect yourself against, I don't know, multiple assailants. It's not like violent criminals, you know, generally say, oh, you know, this should be a fair fight, right? I mean, we're going to carjack that individual, but, you know, we need to do it fair and square. I mean, that's absolutely absurd. By the way, if that's the case, then why do the police need more than 10 rounds? Because the police are exempt from SB 17. Law enforcement can still carry, quote-unquote, large-capacity magazines. Law enforcement will still be able to purchase gas-operated semi-automatic rifles and pistols, which the average Mexican will not be able to do if SB 17 becomes law. And that, unfortunately, is the real danger in this legislation, is it places off limits almost every centerfire semi-automatic firearm that's on the market, certainly for long guns, but many pistols as well. If it can take a detachable magazine, if it has a fixed magazine of more than 10 rounds, and again, it's a gas-operated centerfire rifle or pistol, it's banned under SB 17. Now, there is a grandfather clause in there at the moment. That doesn't mean that it will remain there. And interestingly enough, the sponsor of SB 17 says one of the reasons why this bill is necessary is because violent crime has gone up over the past few years in the state of New Mexico. Not acknowledging that violent crime has gone up with the introduction of universal background checks, red flag laws. You had Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham's attempt to ban concealed carry throughout the entirety of New Mexico, and then throughout the entirety of Albuquerque and Bernalillo County. And then when that was struck down, okay, well, what about parks and playgrounds? And I think ultimately it was limited to playgrounds. That case, by the way, is still being challenged. I think it's before the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals right now. So none of these previous gun control measures have addressed violent crime. I mean, they ostensibly were meant to address violent crime. They haven't done anything to impact violent crime. Violent crime is still going the wrong way in New Mexico. There was a slight improvement in Albuquerque, I think, last year. But again, there was major improvement all across the country, right? FBI says, well, FBI statistics have not come out yet. But the I think it was the Center for Criminal Justice took a look at, you know, violent crime rates, including homicide rates. And I think it was, you know, 40 U.S. cities. And what they found suggests that we actually 2025 may have been the lowest homicide rate since the FBI started recording homicide rates back in 1960. So if Albuquerque is part of that trend, great. But that doesn't mean that it's New Mexico's gun laws that are making a difference, right? We saw much larger reductions in homicides in constitutional carry states, places like Dallas, Texas, Houston, Texas. Anyway, I just thought it was kind of interesting that, you know, and this is not the first time we've seen this, right? I mean, if crime is going up, well, we need violent, we need more gun control because what we have isn't working. If crime is going down, we need more gun control because what we have is not enough, right? But there's always room for improvement. But in this case, under Michelle Lujan Grisham's watch, crime is going in the wrong direction. The gun control measures that she has rammed through the legislature have not made a difference. Certainly have not made the state a safer place, but they have, in fact, targeted legal law-abiding gun owners. All right, so that's what's going on in New Mexico. In South Dakota, we've got a pair of bills coming up, or at least making some progress here. SB 2 passed out of the House Commerce Committee unanimously. Now, note, this is Senate Bill 2, so it's already cleared the Senate. And it is now passed out of the House Commerce Committee. This would remove suppressors from the controlled weapons list at the state level. And this, by the way, has now cleared all the committees. So the next stop is the House floor. It's actually scheduled for a vote today. So South Dakota could essentially deregulate suppressors at the state level as early as this afternoon. That bill, I expect, is going to be signed into law. This is very, very good news for South Dakota residents. You know, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act has zeroed out the $200 transfer tax on suppressors and most other NFA items. But this would, again, make it possible to make it easier to purchase and possess a suppressor in the state of North or South Dakota. There's also a bill scheduled for next Monday in the House Judiciary Committee. It's House Bill 1114. This creates a new category of prohibited persons. Looking at the bill here, the prosecuting attorney shall report to the attorney general for reporting to the NICS background check system the name and any other identifying information of any person who is acquitted of a crime by reason of insanity or is determined to be incompetent to stand trial pursuant to a state statute. Prosecuting attorney shall submit that report to the attorney general no later than 2 hours after the verdict acquitting for insanity or the adjudication of incompetency. The report may not include information relating to the person's diagnosis or treatment, however. So this is interesting. You know, federal law says that those who have been adjudicated as mentally defective have essentially lost their right to keep and bear arms. You know, on the surface, I can't say that I have a huge problem with this. You know, we've talked before about individuals who have been acquitted by virtue of insanity, declared incompetent to stand trial, and they're released back onto the streets, right? Right. There's no consequences for it. Now, personally, what I think should happen is not simply that this individual gets reported to NICS, but because that to me doesn't address the real issue here. If somebody is incompetent to understand or assist in their defense after they've been accused of a crime, if somebody has been deemed not guilty of committing a crime because their mental illness impacted them to the point that they didn't understand that they were committing a violent crime, should they own a gun? Maybe not. Should they be able to own a knife? Probably not. Should they be able to get behind the wheel of a car? I don't think so. If somebody, again, if their mental illness is that severe that they can't face legal consequences for their actions, then they shouldn't be out in public. That doesn't mean you institutionalize them forevermore, but they need to be in a secure psychiatric facility receiving treatment until such a point where they do understand and they are competent to assist in their defense and hopefully not commit a violent crime in the future. That, to me, is what really needs to happen here. So House Bill 1114 in South Dakota, is it the worst bill ever? No. But does it address the real underlying problem? Also, no. Let's see, Nebraska. You've got a hearing coming up. Now, this is going to be next Monday, February 2nd. Nebraska is a constitutional carry state, right? I mean, it took a couple of years in order to get that designation. But it is surprising that they're talking about a ban on the possession of firearms inside the state capitol building. This is not, by the way, as far as I know, the opinion of a majority of lawmakers, but let's make sure it stays that way. The bill number is LB 1237. The executive board is going to be holding a hearing on this again on Monday. If you go to NRAILA.org, there's an alert there for Nebraska gun owners. You can contact members of this committee directly and urge them to oppose LB 1237. You know, again, what we're talking about here are lawful gun owners, right? We're not the problem. And a violent criminal isn't going to pay any attention to a sign that says you can't bring your gun here. We know that that's the case. So what's the point of this legislation, again, other than to intrude and infringe on the rights of law-abiding gun owners? All right, in Florida, it's much the same story that we have seen in recent sessions. The House doing a very good job of passing pro-Second Amendment legislation. They have already passed this session a bill that would repeal the ban on gun sales to 18, 19, and 20-year-olds in the state of Florida. House Bill 1551 is now assigned to the Civil Justice and Claims Subcommittee. This is a measure that would essentially provide protections at the state level to complement the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, one of the bills we'll be talking about in Virginia. And we've already seen this similar legislation in place in states like New York and New Jersey, California, elsewhere. Making it easier to sue gun makers, distributors, sellers over the actions of criminals. You can, you know, blame them for their marketing practices. You know, this isn't saying, well, listen, you sold a gun that was, you know, later used in a crime, therefore you're responsible. It literally can be you had a gun in your store that was stolen and somebody used it in a crime. And we don't think you had good enough security measures, so we're going to sue you. Or we think your advertising and your marketing practices encourage the criminal misuse of a firearm. So even if there's no evidence that a particular criminal saw a particular advertisement, we're still going to hold you to blame for what that criminal did. House Bill 1551 in Florida would essentially say that, no, you can't do that in the Sunshine State. That may be non-controversial enough that the Senate president and Kathleen Passidomo, who is the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I believe, a Rules Committee, maybe they'll let that through. Unfortunately, the bills that would, again, repeal the post-Parkland gun control laws that were put in place, Kathleen Passidomo, when she was Senate president, had no interest in even holding a hearing on those bills. Senator Albritton, who is the new Senate president, replacing Kathleen Passidomo a couple of years ago. Same thing. He essentially says there's no appetite in the Senate for something like this. Well, let's run out the flagpole and see. Put it in committee. Put these House bills in committee. Let's see what the Senate does with them. It is true that there is no Senate companion bill to, you know, the measure repealing the the ban on sales for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. I don't know that that's because there's no interest or desire on the part of Florida state senators to pass such a law. If you've been told by Senate leadership, it's not going to happen. We're not going to hold a hearing. Why would you waste your time writing that bill? So I continue to believe that it's not the Senate itself, but it's Senate leadership that is the real roadblock here to advancing these pro-Second Amendment pieces of legislation. I'd encourage you to contact Senator Albritton and Senator Kathleen Passidomo. I just don't know what good it's going to do. It hasn't done any good in the past sessions. Even Governor Ron DeSantis has been applying pressure to the Senate to no avail. I believe Passidomo is term limited out. Albritton might be actually term limited out as well, but that's really what it's going to take here, is replacing Senate leadership with senators who want to take a stand in support of our right to keep and bear arms, who believe that that right is being violated right now by Florida law, and will work as hard as the House has been working to undo the damage that has been done. And I just don't think it's going to happen in Florida this year. I think the Senate is once again going to be a hurdle. I hope that I'm wrong. I really do hope that I'm wrong. But at the moment, I just don't see any evidence of that. Which takes us back to Virginia, where the Senate Courts of Justice Committee meeting again yesterday. A House committee is set to meet this afternoon and take up a number of House bills restricting our right to keep and bear arms, including the House version of a ban on so-called assault firearms and large capacity magazines. Yesterday, it was the Senate Courts of Justice Committee, once again, hearing a number of bills, including permit to purchase measures. Today is going to be the House Public Safety Firearms Subcommittee, including the House version of a permit to purchase, the semi-automatic ban, and more. So the Senate Courts of Justice Committee yesterday heard Senate Bill 797, Senate Bill 643, both of which established a permit to purchase scheme in the state of Virginia. This bill passed out of the Senate Courts of Justice Committee along party lines. There was a wee bit of concern by one of the Democrats on the committee who noted that in order to rent a firearm in Virginia under this law, you'll have to have a permit to purchase a firearm, which kind of a head scratcher if you ask me. The senator noted, hey, you know, people will go to a range oftentimes. They'll rent a firearm, kind of a try it before you buy it sort of thing, right? If you're requiring somebody to have a permit to purchase before they even go rent a firearm to see if they want to continue to purchase that firearm, which would require a permit to purchase, that's really going to be a hindrance to them. The other Democrats in the Senate Courts of Justice Committee didn't really seem to mind by that. And I understand why, because that's not a bug in this legislation. That's a feature. The entire purpose of a permit to purchase scheme is to reduce the number of gun owners in the state. That's it. To put so many barriers and burdens between the person who wants to buy a gun and their right to do so, that they will throw up their hands in disgust and say, you know what, it's not worth it, I can't afford it. Well, I need a gun now, and I'm going to have to wait 6 weeks. What happens when the stalker who is pursuing me, I don't have time to wait, so I might as well not do it at all. And that will happen. There will be people who will be priced out of the right to keep and bear arms. There will be people who will say, it's just not worth the rigmarole to go through this. The bill was slightly improved. Originally, this was a blanket ban. 18, 19, 20-year-olds were ineligible to get a permit to purchase. That has now been modified so that 18, 19, 20-year-olds could get a permit to purchase long guns, but not handguns, even through a private transfer. So again, if you go to an FFL, right, under federal law at the moment, you got to be 21 to purchase a handgun. In Virginia, you, as the law stands, you don't have to be 21 to purchase or have receive a firearm. But this is one of the reasons why Virginia's universal background check law was struck down by a judge in the state, because you do have to go through a background check. And if you go to an FFL and you go through a background check, and you're 20 years old and you're trying to take possession of a handgun, you're going to be denied because you're not 21. So there's that conflict between state and federal law. The change that was made to the permit to purchase measure doesn't really address that. I mean, they're still hoping that, 21 or 20, 18, 19, 20-year-olds can be barred from possessing handguns. That's clearly the intent here. But it is not a complete gun ban for under 21s. And they would argue, because it's not a complete gun ban, it doesn't violate the Second Amendment. They'd be wrong. If you're telling a grown adult who can vote, who can serve on a jury, who can be drafted, who can fight in the military, who can rent a car, who can live on their own, who can get married, that they can't purchase the most common arm for self-defense, you're violating their Second Amendment rights, plain and simple. We also learned that this permit to purchase bill would require individuals. It's going to be a more onerous process, by the way, than what it takes to get a concealed carry license. And I got to go back and look at the language here, because in some states like Delaware, their permit to purchase law, if you have a concealed carry license, you don't need to get a permit to purchase, which to me just encourages people to go ahead and get the concealed carry license. I don't know that that's the case with these permit to purchase bills in Virginia. It may be that even if you have a concealed carry license, the next time you want to go buy a firearm at a gun store, you've got to provide proof of training that is more onerous than what is required for a concealed carry permit, which means you'd have to go through, you know, another additional training course, pay another fee, get another permission slip from the state before you can buy a firearm. Even, by the way, if you've already got 40 firearms at home, that's what the state is putting in place. And according to a sponsor of this bill, this information that is collected on people who are acquiring a permit to purchase will be sent on to the federal government. Now, I don't know that the Trump administration would do anything with that data. Don't know that they wouldn't. But I'm 100% confident that the next time a Democrat is in the White House, that the data collected on Virginia gun owners would, in fact, be used and put into a database where we would live forevermore. The effective date of this permit to purchase legislation has also changed in the substitute bill that was offered yesterday. Instead of taking effect on July 1st this year, it would be July 1, 2028, which I suppose gives the state more time to develop the standards for training, to set up this permitting process. There's a part of me that wonders, okay, are they pushing this back because they want to introduce this as close as possible to the end of the Trump administration, right? I think it's entirely possible. In fact, I think it's very likely that when this bill takes effect, you will see the DOJ Civil Rights Division file suit against the state of Virginia. Now, if that happens in July of 2026, you know, you've got 2.5 years to litigate that. If the law takes effect July 1, 2028, the DOJ Civil Rights Division has essentially 6 months to litigate that. If a Democrat takes over, you know the Civil Rights Division's not going to be handling Second Amendment cases anymore, right? So they just drop that case entirely. I don't know that that's the reason, or at least the main reason for the delay, but I again, can't help but suspect that it has something to do with moving back the effective date of that legislation. Senate Bill 27 is one of those bills we talked about just a couple minutes ago. It would allow it would allow lawsuits against manufacturers, distributors, and retailers for violating new standards of, quote, responsible conduct. SB 27 requires those businesses to establish and implement, quote, reasonable controls that are vague and subjective over the manufacture, the sale, the distribution, the use, the marketing of firearm-related products. It also creates a broad civil cause of action, which allows the attorney general, local commonwealth attorneys, and even private individuals to sue firearm businesses for injunctions, meaning they could not sell certain products, for damages, and for costs, which, of course, would bankrupt a lot of small FFLs. Ultimately could lead to, you know, the crashing of the firearms industry. This is a way to try to get around the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. And it, too, advanced out of the Senate Courts of Justice Committee. One last bill worth noting in Virginia, SB 364. This establishes a state office, the Virginia Gun Violence Prevention Center, with the stated goal of being, quote, the primary resource for research, best practices, and strategies for the implementation of firearm violence intervention, community-based intervention, and group violence intervention programs designed to reduce violence in communities. So basically, it's a state agency designed to promote gun control. Not every community-based intervention or group violence intervention program is based on the idea of criminalizing lawful gun owners. In fact, many of them are not. But just like we saw with the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, for, you know, every program that looks at the quote-unquote root causes of violent crime, there is another program that's going to be supported that actually goes after gun owners, right? And I suspect that just like with the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, the Virginia Gun Violence Prevention Center is going to be staffed by gun control advocates. It's going to be a jobs placement program for anti-gunners. Some of whom may even have worked at the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. We may see some familiar faces move to Virginia if, in fact, Senate Bill 364 becomes law. And I suspect it will. You know, I wrote about this at Bear in Arms yesterday. I think there is a slight chance. I'd give it less than 5% at the moment. But a slight chance that some senators may be hesitant to move forward with, you know, or let's say removing the grandfather clause for magazine owners turning existing gun owners into criminals overnight, because they're not because of any long held or deeply held belief that the right to keep arms would be violated, but because they're up for election next year. Similarly, Abigail Spanberger, who, you know, ran as a gun sense candidate and said, I'll sign whatever gun control bills get to my desk. Also said during her, I don't think it was her inaugural speech, but it was one of her first speeches. She, you know, I'm a Second Amendment supporter. We got to balance that right, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, she serves a one term, 4 years. She's done as governor. That's just the way it is under Virginia law. She's looking ahead. It could be a Senate run. Could be a run for president. But her last political office is not going to be governor of Virginia. At least I don't think she wants it to be. So that may result in her, you know, wanting to appear moderate, maybe vetoing one or two measures. I don't think, and again, I'm giving even that like a 5% chance. But that's a possibility. So it's discouraging. I've been talking to my fellow gun owners across the state. I would encourage you, keep talking to your delegates, keep talking to your state senators, but also talk to your county supervisors. It is very important to reiterate the Second Amendment sanctuary language that was adopted by the vast majority of counties in 2020 or late 2019. Talk to your county sheriffs, talk to your Commonwealth's attorney, and, you know, urge them to take a public stand in opposition to these bills, to publicly state, hey, listen, I'm not going to charge somebody who's a legal gun owner for having a 17-round magazine. I'm not going to arrest him for that. I'm not going to prosecute him for that. These law enforcement officers, they do have the discretion to say, that's not going to be a priority for me. And it is time, I think, for those elected officials, and that's what Commonwealth attorneys and sheriffs are in Virginia. It is time for those elected officials, I think, to take a public stand in opposition to these bills, not just testifying before the legislature, although that'd be helpful too, but to alleviate the concerns of their constituents that these laws will not be enforced, at least at the local level. Virginia State Police, yeah, they'll do Spanberger's bidding, I'm sure. But, you know, the Prince Edward County Sheriff, the Caroline County Sheriff, the Goochland County Commonwealth's Attorney, they don't have to. And I hope that they don't. So that's kind of where we are right now in, you know, states that are seeing bills on the move. You might have noticed I did not mention California. That's because we don't have any gun control bills on the move in California right now. Not because Gavin Newsom has suddenly seen the light when it comes to the Second Amendment. But as we talked with Rick Travis from CRPA a few weeks ago, California's budget hole is so deep right now that any gun control bill with any kind of fiscal impact, Democrats are just having to hold off for the moment. We may see that in Virginia in the years to come, by the way. Governor Youngkin left the state with a $2.7 billion surplus, but Democrats are already spending that and looking to raise taxes on Virginians to the tune of about $2,000 a year, according to the Virginia GOP Senate members. So maybe we'll get a respite in Virginia, but only because Democrats can't afford to pass any more gun control measures, but it's not going to happen this session. It does, however, look like Californians are going to get a breather, at least for the time being. We'll keep our eyes on what's going on out there out west as well, and we'll do another roundup of the states here. You know, I don't know if we'll do it weekly while the legislature's in session, but certainly biweekly. We'll keep you abreast of what's going on in states across the country. Right now, though, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Arkansas. U.S. Marshals arrest man accused of stabbing woman in Springdale, Arkansas. This is in the northwest part of the state up near Fayetteville. And as it turns out, this guy, well-known to law enforcement, 25-year-old Ladarius Green, accused of attempted capital murder, kidnapping, and theft of property. This happened, I believe it's been a couple of days. I think it was earlier this month, let's just say Sunday before last. When officers arrived at the scene, they found a female with stab wounds, transported to a local hospital for treatment. Officers soon identified Green as a suspect in the case. He was reported to have left the scene in a vehicle that contained a young juvenile passenger. The vehicle was found involved in an accident in Fayetteville. The juvenile was still in the car, but Green had fled the scene. That would be, I believe, the kidnapping charge coming into play. Green was taken into custody about 3 days later and is now facing, again, a variety of charges. He also has several previous run-ins with the law. In June of 2020, Green was charged with aggravated assault on a family or household member, second-degree domestic battery, and second-degree endangering the welfare of a minor. In July of 2021, he was arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault, third-degree domestic battery, and terroristic threatening. And in July of 2022, he pleaded guilty to both of those cases. He was sentenced to 10 years at the Arkansas Department of Corrections, 7 years of which were immediately suspended. So he got a 3-year sentence in July of 2022 for both of these cases involving domestic assault. 2 years later, he was out. So much for the 3-year sentence. July of 2024, Green was one of 4 men arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault, engaging in a violent criminal group activity, as well as a parole violation after a security guard was beaten and stabbed outside of a bar in May of 2024. Green ended up pleading guilty. Now, again, remember, suspicion of aggravated assault, engaging in a violent criminal group activity, as well as violating his parole. Green pleaded guilty to a reduced charge of third-degree battery in September of 2024, was sentenced to a single year of probation and a $1,000 fine. The 10-year sentence that he received in July of 2022, remember, 7 years of that suspended, that suspension could have been revoked. Green could have been sent to prison to serve the entirety of that 10-year sentence, or at least with time off for good behavior, probably looking at 5 or 6 years. But for whatever reason, that didn't happen. And then last summer, Green was arrested again on suspicion of terroristic threatening and fleeing, pleaded guilty in October in that case, and once again was sentenced to 1 year probation, along with court costs and fines of $650. And then, on November 23rd, 2025, so just about a month ago, he was arrested on suspicion of 2 counts of fourth-degree sexual assault. Prosecutors have yet to file formal charges in connection with that case. So, yeah, this is Arkansas. And this isn't, you know, liberal Minnesota. This isn't Oregon. This is Arkansas. Red state, ruby red state of Arkansas. And yet we still see individuals who should be behind bars offered plea deals that result in nothing more than probation. A plea deal that, frankly, Green would have been stupid not to accept. Okay, so he pleads guilty to a crime. Well, he's already got a criminal record. So what's the punishment? Probation. All right, well, he's already violated probation before. And what happened? Nothing. So, yeah, he'd be a moron not to accept a deal like that. I'm pretty sure that Green isn't the brightest bulb in the chandelier, but he or his attorney, smart enough to know a good deal when they see one. Good deal for the defendant, by the way, not for the interest of justice. On to today's armed citizen story from Stockton, California, where police say employees acted in self-defense at a Stockton flea market. 2 men were killed. A woman was injured in this case. It turns out this was a robbery. June 18th at a flea market there in Stockton. The stall in question sold jewelry. And I guess workers in that stall had lawfully possessed firearms, able to use it in self-defense. Again, the 2 male robbers who were engaged in that robbery attempt were shot and killed. A woman who was part of the robbery attempt as well was wounded, suffering a non-life-threatening injury. She's facing charges, but the workers there at the jewelry shop not facing charges because they acted in lawful self-defense. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A tow truck driver in Texas who helped save a man from icy water, and I believe this is a Segoville, I think that's how you pronounce it. Again, if I'm wrong and you're a Texan and you can correct me, please let me know. Always happy to get the correct pronunciation there. This was over the weekend. Actually, no, it was Tuesday, I believe. Douglas Lane, tow truck driver, 41 years old. He told the Fox affiliate in Dallas-Fort Worth he still hasn't really fully processed what happened. But he was driving down the road, I guess. He saw a man acting erratically in a highway drainage culvert. And he said he heard the man shouting for help. And then he noticed the guy was kind of bobbing up and down in the water. I guess Texas got a ton of, at least the North Texas got a ton of precipitation. So Lane called 911. That was the first thing he did. He tried to rescue the man on his own, but the guy was too heavy and he couldn't pull him out of the water. When officers arrived on scene, though, they, along with Lane, were able to extricate the guy out of that ditch. He was unresponsive by the time they got him out. But officers also saw signs of drug abuse, so they administered Narcan. And apparently that worked. The man's vehicle found nearby. He was treated for hypothermia, taken to a local hospital. He remains in the ICU. And officials say that if Lane had gotten there even, you know, 2 minutes later, it might have been too late to save this individual. The Segovia Police Department says they want to award Lane and commend him at an upcoming city council meeting. Chief Steve Davis there in the Segovia said that if Lane hadn't responded, the man would have died. He said he had a faint pulse. He was non-responsive. Eyes were rolled back in his head. And he said whenever I reached down there to grab him, that's when his head was underwater. Lane, meanwhile, says he was scared for the guy, but he was able to remain calm. He said, you know, my instinct was to say, oh, no, well, you're not going to do this when his face went in the water. And I reached in there, he said. And he credits his grandmother for his good deed, saying that she's the one that taught me to always help strangers, always help somebody in need. He says, that's what I went with. I just helped him. Well, in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. Douglas Lane, there in the Segovia, Texas, we thank you for your very... very good deed. Now, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. Have a great weekend. Looks like some of us may be in store for some more wicked winter weather. Right now, knock on wood, looks like Central Virginia is going to be all right, so my power should be on. I should be back with you on Monday. Hopefully I'll be able to leave the property by then, able to get out. But if not, long as I'm able to turn the lights on, power up the computer, we'll have a Bearing Arms Cam & Company. We will certainly have plenty to talk about. Until then, be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the rest of the week and the weekend, keeping up to date again on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information. Also, next Tuesday, going to be joining William Kirk, Washington Gun Law. Special live event on YouTube, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific. That, again, is next Tuesday. I'm looking forward to that. We'll be talking more about that on Monday's Cam & Company. But set your calendar. Should be a great conversation. And until we talk again, be well, be safe, and be free.